Can you talk about it? Good evening. So it's 7 o'clock. I just wanted to get started. Does anybody know if anybody else is on the way, or like your friend called you, said they're looking for parking? Can everybody hear me? Okay. So I'm Mike Hester. I'm a sergeant with the Columbia Police Department. I think I know most of you guys, and you know me. On Saturday, November 5th, I shared the fair and impartial policing training that we give to our officers, and I promised that I would take feedback, suggestions, observations from you guys. My intended outcome is to make this training better for our officers and to make this training available and at community standards, you know, and that's kind of a hard porcupine to juggle there. We have to be the police. We have to do police actions. And I think understanding better that we're trying to take steps to address our implicit bias might help folks participate with us better. When I say participate, in healing our community and in taking our community to a better spot. So as promised, that's what we're going to do. Now, I was asked earlier, and I just want to get this out of the way. I showed a slide during, I'll just show it to you again. Where did, I showed this slide during the training, and I challenged everyone. I only gave you a binary decision. Is this the first page of a pornographic magazine publication, or is this a woman who has committed herself to going to biker rallies with the Sisters of Christ evangelical motorcycle gang to tell bikers about God? And the setup I gave you was nobody at a biker rally would want to walk up and listen or talk to me. So a lot of people have emailed me and asked me. So here's the answer. Who here thinks that she's with Sisters of Christ motorcycle evangelical motorcycle gang? And who here thinks it's some kind of demeaning pictorial about women? All right. The good news is everybody's wrong. This picture, if you remember from the class, is an ambiguous stimuli. Ambiguous means you don't know the whole story, or it's vague. You're unaware of all the facts involved, and you just can't even really categorize what it is. Stimuli means it's something that gets the attention of one of your five senses, right? It makes something in your brain or, you know, take notice. So the picture of this poor woman is an ambiguous stimuli, especially when I set a context that was confusing or unclear. And the reason that I use this description of this picture is when one of our cops goes out tonight and it's dark and someone says someone is acting suspicious and looks like they're up to no good, everybody in this room probably has a different definition of suspicious and up to no good. And so that's what we shove our cops into the middle of, and then we wonder why they do stupid things or things we disagree with, or we don't understand why they did the right thing, or they might do something reasonable that later is proven not to be right, but everybody's unhappy. And so that's kind of the meat grinder we shove our police officers into. So this picture is an ambiguous stimuli. It's neither nor. So, but it's...
I would argue it's still a picture of a chicky thing.
Okay. She says it's still offensive with a come hither look.
Nastiness to her, the way she looks. And she's not going to go
you
to church.
You can choose many images for ambiguous stimuli, and I wouldn't have chosen that.
Okay. Go ahead.
I haven't had any training, but I'm just going to look at that and say, let me be a little cautious because she's looking like she's going to challenge me, maybe, verbally, I think. So let me go check it out, but be careful.
Well, that, oh,
your mind can wander by looking at this picture you gave us. Two choices.
Binary choice, that's right.
To make a point.
Yes.
So all of this other stuff is of little or no consequences when it's brought into context with the training. The training was specifically, mm-hmm. is this A or is this B?
Right.
Some people are going to believe it's A, you had them, they raise their hands. Some
right.
people believe it's B, they raise their hands, and they're both wrong. People can't accept being wrong. It's simple.
Well, a couple things about this. As the instructor, it's fun to, well, I shouldn't say fun, but it's fascinating to sit up in front and watch the looks on different people's faces. Some people are offended. I've had people say that it's neither. This woman looks mad that she's having her picture taken. Some people say, somebody I think in here said it was a Japanese motorcycle, so she wouldn't be an outlaw motorcycle reverend or whatever. This picture was selected by Professor Lori Friedel of Florida State University, who designed this training module. So she incorporated this as a ambiguous stimuli, and it's just a way, it's a mechanism that if your mind's going to wander, as human brains are wont to do, which way is it going to wander and why, and I won't say why because that's not part of the training, but it just kind of shows the drift there. So I do.
Have more time when you're dealing with officers and not interrupted so much by people like us, if that's something that would be included, the discussion we're having now.
Oh, I think
in the training that you officers, right?
The when we have this with officers, this really it's almost a carbon copy of the conversations that go on.
Yeah.
And I've even had officers say, well, this is ridiculous, what's this have to do with being a cop? Or it's really, in my experience, the exact same conversation. You know, why did you choose this image? Well, I didn't. Lori did. Why couldn't it be this or that? You know, this is a tool, right? Like, so we put this picture up here, and people follow their bias, and sometimes they verbalize it while they're following it. So how does this apply to policing? When a cop goes out here and encounters someone for something, if they're not aware of their implicit bias, they'll follow kind of like the discussion has. You know, it's like I said, some people see a mad woman, some people see a come hither look, some people see different things. So it's, I just wanted to give you guys the answer. And I don't know if that addressed your point.
I guess I was wondering how different the training that we saw in the short workshop for 4 hours was from how it is when you're dealing with officers. You know, we interrupted a lot and we didn't get to discuss this further, and you know what I mean?
Well, Jeff, when we teach this in service, it goes kind of the same rhythm. I mean, I was really worried when we thought, okay, we're going to put this on. I thought I'd be on slide 3 on hour 5, if you know what I'm saying. Like, I'd say lunch, and we'd be on this, like, the first slide. No, it's kind of... It's because it's one of those things, and that's what I want, is for people to feel like, well, wait a minute, I challenge that, or I agree. I mean, I think that's how people get more out of it, is being involved. So, somebody had their hand up. Frank?
How many hours do you actually do this for the police?
This is the exact same time frame. In fact, the reason it was from 10 p.m. till 3 a.m., or 3 p.m., excuse me, we're still here. The reason it was from 10 p.m. till 3 p.m. is this year in our in-service block for every officer, that's where it fell. So I wanted to replicate, you know, the only difference is the cops, when we do this, about 30 minutes into their lunch break, I would go and say, hey, come on back, let's keep moving. So they did get a little bit more, but they were eating. Well, not just for this picture. They got a little bit more discussion, but they were all eating, so they couldn't discuss much. Lieutenant Jones.
I go to these meetings, not just this training, but other meetings, that people fail to recognize, both as the police and other people in the community, is that we're all from different types of backgrounds. You know, we have cops that came from poverty, we have cops that came from
affluence.
We have cops that work as chemists, teachers, you name it. You know, mechanics, plumbers. They just come from a wide variety of different circumstances. And it's the same when we come into this training, and the community mirrors our police officers, really. We all come from these different backgrounds, but we all have bias based on all of these different factors. But it's interesting to me to hear the questions asked and hear that are the same questions that are asked by police officers in the very same training. I guess the answer is it's a lot of the same.
Yeah. You know, another thing that I was thinking about when I was coming tonight and thinking about what I wanted to bring up as far as points.
Sure.
Is the point that you made as far as that in reducing the biases, it protects both the officer and the public. It kind of segues into what you were talking about, that in receiving that training, not only does it protect us, but it protects the officer and everybody involved.
It's a win-win situation by doing it. More is really good, right?
Yeah, and I'm hopeful, too, when we did the scenario, when you talked about the police being able to, the officers having a route for reporting things that they see within the ranks, I was interested in hearing a little bit more about that, if it's possible.
Sure.
As far as, you know, it was talked about like it was a given that culture exists, and I would just be interested in knowing how that plays out as far as their, you know, the protection for the officer that does report it and what the process.
All right. Let me come back to you.
Along the lines of more is better, the one bullet point I wrote down from the training is as follows. High quality role play use of force training. I happen to prefer rather than use of force response to resistance. The quality role play, high quality role play use of force training helps police unlink race and crime for split second use of force decisions. I'm on the Citizens Police Review Board, and Chief Burton did his semi-annual presentation, if you will, this past Wednesday, and I asked him the same question I'm going to ask you.
Okay.
Not that your answer would be any different, but I spent 43 years in one industry.
Okay.
In order to stay proficient, I needed constant reminders of things that I had learned and needed to keep out in front.
That's a subject I also...
People, Chief Burton said that this training is a part of the ongoing training for all officers, even refresher training. Sense I got, though, was that the frequency with which that refresher training takes place, at least for me personally, would be insufficient.
I have something to just add before you respond to that, in that, you know, we've had a whole lifetime of learning our biases and figuring this stuff out. It's really hard, uncomfortable work.
Yeah.
And 1 4-hour session is a really good start. It's going to open a lot of doors. It's going to make people curious, make them want to read. So, A, are resources provided for further training of the individual? Are there benefits or rewards for doing that for police officers, right? Are they acknowledged for seeking out information and sharing it? And how, what does continuing education look like? It can't just be 1 4-hour session once a year, because I've been working on this stuff and reading and squirming and feeling really shitty about it for a year. And, you know, 1 4-hour session's only a good start. So that's just right. To add to what he had to say.
Well, mine really wasn't a question. Mm-hmm. It was encouragement to do it.
To do more.
To do it more often than what I think current resources allow.
How does it look more? Do you guys do more?
Well, this is this training repeated for officers that have even gone through it?
The challenge is, so in 2017, right, so this is what we taught in 2016. I stay in contact with Lori Friedel. She designed and created this course. And so in 2017, we're going to try to have more, which was another reason I wanted to get everybody's feedback. Because like Lieutenant Jones said, the officers, it's almost the exact same give and take. I mean, like I said, I let you guys have a full lunch hour. But I don't think repeating just this training would be beneficial. Okay.
It seems to be different scenarios would help in the quote-unquote follow-up training.
Right. Absolutely.
So increased frequency if time allows, and different roles, different situations.
Yeah. Continuing conversation is good. You know, now we have all these resources with social media that people can share articles and read and comment on them. And what's the work environment like? Is this something that is esteemed by the officers after they've done it and they're talking about it amongst each other and saying, you know what, I read this great book. It really set me on this path to this really interesting book. You might want to read this or look at that article. How does that play into how officers might respond to it? And is that encouraged, or is there a structure for that within the CPD? Maybe the communications department would be good people to promote that, right? We use a lot of social media these days, and people share a lot of stuff, and it makes you think. And you can discuss it and converse and maybe develop your ideas further, you know. And I know time and resources are an issue, and I don't really have any idea what the communication department has on tap already, but that seemed like the obvious place to look for sharing stuff and keeping an ongoing discussion throughout the year that officers can benefit from, because they're safer and we're safer and everybody wins. But that's always a good scenario when everybody wins. We could do that.
Yeah, I think for 2017 we're going to have more role plays. In other words, I drafted two poor folks out of the... Remember, I drafted a couple of people out of the audience and just threw them in there. But I think what you're saying about sharing articles and comments is important. And I think acting it out, you know, like visibly, because that's a different human experience, right?
It's very different when people see it versus when you're reading something on a page. There's a different part of your brain that's working there.
Right.
And a different level of understanding that's working there. So good role plays can be really effective.
There's huge research with the kids on that.
As
far as that they, when they're being taught certain concepts, that they're actually involved in
and
role playing, that
it changes
they learn,
the way they see it.
With them more.
And also when you do the facial recognition exercises, that can really shift. You know, if you do some facial recognition exercises, it can really shift your perception of the people in your community. And when you do the racial bias, implicit bias thing online, is that Harvard or Yale has that test? And that's really eye-opening.
Yeah.
You just go there and they log the results of people, and you can see. They give you a bunch of different images really fast, and you just go through it, it's 15 minutes. And that would be a great resource to offer the officers to see, to show them where maybe there's a weakness that they want to digest.
So just to address a couple of points here, and sorry for interrupting, but I don't want to forget what you said. you know, I think more frequency is important, you know, with the use of force simulator, with what you're saying, you know, these online resources that already exist and the social media. I will say the officers who go through this, it surprised me the first time I taught the class, because I thought, oh, man. Because usually I teach stuff like firearms and handcuffing and, you know, kind of the fun, cool stuff. Well, I realized, well.
Because he read. He started reading, right?
So I thought, man, here's, you know, it's cool to go to the shooting range, right? Everybody likes that. Most everybody likes that. Some don't. And I thought this is going to be like, but people seem to enjoy this class, you know, and I hear them talking about it later, and I hear them teasing each other, like, watch what you're doing. I mean, so it's on their mind, which is good. It shows it hasn't gone away. Yeah. To push that and encourage that is, you know, kind of what we're doing tonight. I think positive feedback to our department, to the officers that they've gone through this, would cement it in their mind. Now, I want to address her question, because she had one, and I think I misspoke, and I want to come back to what you said. So her question earlier, and then I want to come back to this, but I feel bad because her question earlier was, what's in place for an officer to report bad behavior, and what's the culture like, and what's it look like for an officer to report bad behavior?
I would add, does that happen? Do they report bad behavior?
Yes.
And how often?
Okay, so here's what it looks like. In our response to resistance policy, which commonly would be called a use of force policy, right? The first part of our use of force policy is an admonition from the chief to report excessive force. So, sure.
I found myself something popping in my head.
Sure.
Is it in any way similar? Like, I spent a career teaching elementary and middle school, and I was considered a mandatory reporter, as far as any kind of abuse or neglect and that kind of thing. And I found myself thinking, is there any kind of equivalence within law enforcement that not only are they encouraged to do this, but required to do this? Is there any kind of equivalence, not to compare those, because I know they're two very different things, but is there any kind of assurance to the public that there's the culture has that in it?
So what she's asking is, like a teacher, a policeman, a doctor, if they find out about child abuse, Missouri law says they shall report it to, Children's Protective Services, right? If you hear about it or told about it or see it, you must report. That's what a mandated reporter is. There's no, well, gosh, I think this or that. Within our policy, the chief's admonition is if you see excessive force occurring, you shall report it. And shall is a big legal term. And in our code of conduct policy, you are to report any policy violation, right? So the onus is on the officer to report it. And for two reasons. One is by policy, okay? So it is in there, similar to what you're talking about, a mandated report. Hold on one second. And the other part is what I said and what every cop, when I teach this to the police, they nod along with me. There is no profit or
benefit,
thank you, that's the word I was looking for the police to hide bad police behavior. If somebody's going out here and being a jerk, abusive, discriminatory, biased, you name, there's no benefit to me as the next officer that encounters that citizen. It doesn't make my job easier. And when I say that, please understand our cops are not lazy, but our cops are human beings. And nobody wants their job to be harder. Like if you've ever worked in any kind of customer service field, you don't want that guy at the desk who makes everybody mad and then like, hey, this guy up here is mad, but I'm going to lunch. Can you finish when I started here? You don't want to be that follow-up person. Does that make sense?
Officers who do report it, and how much do officers report?
I can't give you numbers like down to the number, but I'll tell you this. I know. We all want to hear. I'll tell you what I feel like people want to hear. They want to hear that last year 7 officers were fired for bad behavior, or 5, or 1. Right.
They don't need to be fired.
Right. And I can tell you that I have heard officers' names as far as being abusive, being a jerk, doing things not to the extent of that ticket scenario that we did. Remember that? And I've pulled them aside and said, hey, you can be a police officer and do that, but you can't be a police officer here or anywhere I know in Missouri. So you can either stop it or I'll get you fired. And I've said that to their face, and I have high-fived those same cops in the hallway because they don't hold it against me. I haven't become like this pariah because how dare I challenge one of our colleagues. That, in fact, just the opposite has happened because the people who are doing their job as best they can, they appreciate that.
And they're making everybody safer. I'm sure everybody appreciates that. And as a public, we don't really know what that culture of potential pushback for speaking up is, or how obligated an officer feels to say, that guy's being a dick and you need to talk to him, right?
Lieutenant Jones.
So I'll make 2 points. First, police officers, occasionally you'll hear of an officer that other cops don't want to go calls on.
It becomes apparent.
We don't like to get in fights because that means we have to be reviewed, you know, everything's on video. And sometimes you'll deal with those officers who just, they're abrasive. And it's not a policy violation, it's just maybe
we just
experience,
see that
maybe,
it's
you don't know,
not
but
good.
You know that it doesn't, I don't need that. Thank you, Doc. I love you, but I don't know. But they, the officers themselves know who those people are, and the officers will put peer pressure on them. I don't want to get in a fight today. Keep your attitude in check. Make sure that you're coming to work in the right mindset. They will regulate that on its own before it ever becomes a policy violation, before it ever becomes a scenario or to the level we discuss it. They do that themselves, and they have for years and years.
Well, that's true. Okay, go ahead.
The other thing is that police officers have a bad day. And as supervisors, we'll talk to officers and make the point that you have to watch out for the other officers. Take care of your partner. And that's not in the context of hide things or don't, and we're explicit in this. We're not telling you to hide things. We're not telling you to not report things. We are telling you to get to that problem for your, if your partner's having problems at home and they're not acting the way that they should, they're not talking right to people, we're telling them, take care of your partner. Make sure that you guys are talking, and if you have to intervene before it gets to that point, do it. I mean, we go to, Mike teaches at the academy some too, and I teach at the academy. I have that same conversation with the cops there. So we really, it's not the overt acts of bias, discrimination that you might think that we see. It's these undertones that this training helps us to identify and helps us to be more vocal about. And we really, for years, especially in Columbia, have been really good about dealing with that. I think that we're even better now than we used to be, if that makes any sense. I don't know if that helps answer your question. It is more a culture of doing the right thing than it is having to regulate it, because we really are, at an officer level even, dealing with that in pretty effective ways. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that, Mike?
So let me just follow up one thing with her, because I want to, and so there's policy, there's what he's talking about. The culture, sure. I mean, we call it, is it okay there, buddy, if I sit down? I mean, I can stand up front behind the podium if you guys want. But.
Welcome to the meeting, and I want to,
no, but anyhow. So, I mean, I feel like we're, the chief, I think, has tried very hard to institute his philosophy and his guidelines to the department and hold people accountable. And I think nobody down here has fought that. It's kind of interesting. I don't know, like you said, you'd been in teaching. It's, if you've ever supervised anybody, I feel like I'm best as a supervisor when people think, oh, he's a rule book guy. Like, he follows the rules. With a little bit of, here's a human side. Like, if someone's had some horrible home event, you might look past a mistake of the mind a little bit, but not a mistake of the heart. And there's a difference there. You know, people have bad days. Police are people. And I feel like what you're hearing is maybe me saying we're the police, trust us, and that's not what I'm trying to say. What I am trying to say is we've got a rule book. We have a drive to not be involved in any more violence than we're already forced to be. I mean, I have injured elbow, knee, neck, wrist, finger, but, you know, it's just not, it's not profitable. It's not beneficial. Better word that you hear. So, does that answer your question? I just want to make sure. Okay, sorry. I just want to. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about benefits, not just in terms of the police force, but these guys are my colleagues. I'm a city worker. And anything in my mind that happens to them happens to me. When they have a bad day and a citizen is upset, that citizen is going to be upset with me too if he or she finds out that I'm a public servant. So there is no benefit to anyone from any public servant's bad behavior. We all reflect on each other. Likewise, we should all support each other.
That was one of the other images that I, there were a couple of big takeaways for me. I still keep picturing that officer at the kitchen sink cleaning all the baby bottles during that raid with all the children screaming and crying and thinking about their, you know, his assessment of the situation and that's his heart was there, but also his training told him, you know, we need to get things calmed down so we can talk to people. And I just found such a heart for all the things you guys face, including those tender things like taking care of the babies.
Yeah, I mean, that has gone on, you know, that doesn't usually make the news, right? And usually we don't make a big deal about it. But I can tell you that the men and women in this department are doing things like that probably every day, similar, you know, to what they're doing.
Sorry if I cry. I have some bad people with the police, too. And I've had them beat me up, and I've had one stop it. And I love that. And they were beating me up, saying, quit resisting arrest. And I'm not. They're beating me with the stick and they're kicking me. Okay? They gave me about 4 or 5 tickets. Didn't arrest me, because they knew they were wrong. They were all dropped. So the second time, I had a warrant for my arrest. And I went and took care of that. And I knew better. I forgot to get a sheet of paper to keep on me in case they stopped me if they hadn't went through. And I said I should go back. And I said, well, it'll be all right. They saw me in a car and was riding with somebody. We stopped and they grabbed me and pulled me out of the car, threw me down and started beating me with the stick saying, you have a warrant for your arrest. And I kept saying, I don't. Another police car drive up or two, and one stopped him and said, stop beating him. He doesn't have any, he's saying I've got drugs and stuff. This is during the time y'all was really, you walk the streets, they go, let me go get your eyes. You know, it stopped now.
Was this here in Columbia?
So this one officer stopped him, you know, and the neighbors were looking and said, you should go up there. That's a shame they're doing this. There was no need me going up there. He kept saying, I said, I just come from court. I don't have a warrant for it. Well, they even called up there while we was there. And they said, yes, he went to court. And the officer kept saying, that ain't enough. I'm going to still take you down. And all these other officers, they stood by me. So I did what he was supposed to do. He took me down there and did this, that, and knew. And so he said, now, you can go. I said, well, you're going to give me a ride home. He said, no. And you still have a warrant for your arrest. That's how he treated me. I can tell you what year it was, probably.
When was that? When was that?
I just moved on the veterans campus. I said it was about.
I'm sorry that happened.
But I'm okay. What makes me feel good is that one officer stopped him.
Yeah.
You know? And so when they called, we were all there. And they said, yes, he went to court. Yes, that's not enough. He wanted to give me a hard time.
Right.
But I'm so glad this one out of all
one
of them,
officer.
But that was still good.
It's one officer with a nightstick, that's a problem.
Yes, but when they beat me the first time, there was nobody to stop them. You know, and it scared me. It really scared me because I was actually an old man and they doing this and I'm down there. And he said, I'm not doing anything. And they kept kicking. It scared me.
And this is what you guys have to fight against.
And they didn't arrest me.
People are going to
They
be
did not arrest me.
What
they
year was that?
Because of past experiences.
I don't think you could probably look it up. They did not arrest me. They gave me a ticket for, let's see, resisting arrest or,
I had a terrible experience.
It was 4 or 5 tickets.
In Key Kansas.
And so they said, are you going to arrest him? And they said, no. And I said, I know why you're not going to arrest him, because you know you were wrong. But I had to get a public defender, okay?
You had to enter the whole system and deal with
that. And wait a minute, when I talked to the public defender, first time, he said, well, we're going to plead guilty to the... And I said, do you know what they did to me for nothing? And he was going like, well, how much was your bond? I said, bond, I never went to jail. I said, wait a minute, are you my lawyer? Well, he had this set up, I guess, with them that I said, sorry, I'm not pleading with them. They dropped everything. But I wonder why he was so wanting me to have a record. I just couldn't understand it.
And would he have treated me the same way if there was a warrant for a ticket not paid?
And then I'll just tell you another incident. I was at the mall and I saw this cute girl. And I was just talking to her, didn't know her, and just talking to her women's store. Well, she was stealing. She stole out of this women's store. And I saw her and I said, what did you do that for? That scared me. Okay? And so these ladies, I guess they kind of saw her. Okay? So they knew I didn't. So I went on down to the record store. And this police come in, he said, were you down to this woman's store? I said, yes, sir. I said, why? He said, I need you to go back down here with me. I said, well, sure. I said, I haven't sold anything. He said, if I thought you sold something, I've already handcuffed you. I said, well, sure. So we go down to the woman's store, and she was going like, well, they were going like, who was that girl? And I said, I didn't know her. I said, I saw her in the mall this day. And I told them the truth, okay? So they left me alone, because they knew I didn't steal it. They left me in the store. So I left. The next day at my house, they knocked on my door. And said, can we talk to you again about the incident of the mall? I said, sure. I told all the black men that I knew, I felt so bad, how they can trick you, especially these young ones, okay? They said, could you go down to the station with us? To talk about that incident. I said, sure. I said, can I ride with y'all? Say my guess, are you running back? Sure. Soon as I got in her car, she said, I tell you what, if you don't tell us who that girl is, we're going to arrest you for that. And I said, for what? I said, I told you I did not know who that girl was, and I didn't. They arrested me.
Did you feel preyed upon?
Yes.
And
I felt my rights were violated.
Now, hold on, did this happen in Columbia?
Yes.
How long ago? So we can look into
this. Oh, I don't know. Please
I'll tell you what,
Paul,
you have that conversation before we get up, because you're going to have to get personal.
Yeah.
Make sure this wait and we'll get that.
Sure.
But I would just point out that the effect of one or two officers having a really bad day is magnified, because he's going to talk to everybody he knows.
Hold on one second. So we have a sign interpreter here. So when too many people talk, they can't keep up. That's what my note says here. So I'm just trying to... Yeah.
Okay. I was trying to buy this truck from another guy who was exactly just like mine. Parked on private property where they were doing that drug thing every day. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that they looked my license plate up in Crawford before they attacked me.
Okay. Well, now, hold on a second. Now, see, when you say you're sure... That means that you're assigning an action to someone.
Okay, well,
but now hold on. Okay. What the things you've recounted here? Number one, if those things happen, I'm truly sorry. And the only reason I say is if is we need to look into this. So if it's okay with you, hold on.
I told him I was there. Because I was trying to buy this truck. Okay, and they thinking I got drugs. Okay. And they were telling about, and I'm trying to tell them, I showed them the candy this man. They were choking me, and I thought they were going to show me. And I was going like this, oh, God, you're going to kill me, you're going to kill me. Trust me, I had to stop him. He would have killed me. He would have. And they started beating me with the sticks. You're resisting arrest. And I'm saying, I'm not. Finally, they stopped. They took me to the station. They wanted to go to the hospital, x-ray me and all this stuff. It was sad. Here was the saddest part where I cried. When they took me to the police station, he comes in with this rubber glove and thought I was going to let him stick his finger down my throat. And I said to him, no, you're not. I said, the only person going to do that is a doctor, like I said. But I felt so bad for these young blacks. Are they letting them do stuff like that to them? And all this kind of stuff. When I go to the hospital, they had beat me up. And they were supposed to be x-raying me where they x-raying my stomach. And I'm going, wait a minute. That's not where I'm hurting. I had to get up out of there. They made me walk home. I told my family. They couldn't believe it. They dropped all those tickets. They didn't arrest me either. They dropped all those tickets. All I paid for, and I just went ahead and did it, was indirect use of some kind of whatever. But it was, that was most scared. I was really, he would kill me. Okay. If I hadn't stopped it, because I could have stuck it with him. Me.
All right, so, but sir, I'm going to have to stop you because okay. this sounds like an internal affairs complaint. So the question earlier was, what's in place to address bad behavior? So I would like, before you leave, if I can get your phone number and we can get you to talk to our internal affairs investigators. Because this is the kind of behavior that, so you're alleging criminal behavior on the part of the police. You're saying they alleged it on you. We need to look into this. Now, hold on. I don't think we should talk about it anymore in a public forum for your benefit and for the officers, but this is the kind of thing, like, I have to stop you, not that I don't think it happened, but I want to find facts on this, right? And that's what I think that's the right thing to do. Does that make sense? So please, before you leave, I mean, Joe has my number, and I think you have my number. But I would like to get you in touch with our internal affairs investigator.
I can even tell myself I'm not scared that they're going to stop me walking home. Mm-hmm. I can see a whole bunch. It's about better.
Okay. Well, I'm glad it's better, but I'm sorry that's happened. But this is the kind of stuff we need to look into, okay?
I would worry about the younger black kids that they'll make them say things that they...
We can't really discuss this anymore. Okay.
Well, and if you widen out the focus, you can talk about how incidents like that, we don't know the context.
Yeah.
We don't know the specifics. But the stories are going to get repeated within certain areas of our community.
Right.
Right? And it's going to be multiplied and multiplied and multiplied, and it undermines the public trust, which makes officers less safe, and it makes the public less safe because the officers are going to be more wary because they know that the public doesn't trust them, and it's like the downward spiral.
Right.
It doesn't take much, but, right, a couple of incidents, and the ripples are going to be felt by everybody, both in the community and for the officers and their safety and efficacy.
You make a good point that you have to give context because we hear and see a lot of things, and you mentioned social media, and that can be very good.
And even without the context, right?
Without context, yep. Because I think every police officer in this room, and you've had a lot of interaction with me, I'm pretty straightforward in what I say. If I have to fight somebody at work, if I have to apply force to overcome resistance, I will do it.
Yeah.
I have children at home, I have a wife at home, and I care to get home.
Okay? And that's totally valid.
Right. But out of context, it will never be pretty.
And even out of context, because social media, nobody checks anything. They don't look for context. They know nothing.
Right? Yeah, it's weird that we have the most...
That's why even something that might seem relatively benign from the view of the officers... can get interpreted and magnified in the view of the community. So it's really, really important that everybody is paying attention and behaving
right.
as best they can. And the partners are watching out for one another. And the training is really good and ongoing. And
yeah,
maybe
I think...
Maybe mitigate some of those effects.
So he's saying that things are better now. And I'm glad to hear that. I mean, is that right? And that's important. And that goes back to your point of the training. And that's why, you know, somebody was asking me earlier, you know, how did I come upon this course or why did I think this course was important?
you know, bias may have had some driving factor, or your behavior, or what the cops thought was going on. Somewhere in there is the truth, right? It's all, it's never just one little circle. But hold on one second. So what she's saying is this training illuminates to people. Right. But so you were saying you think everybody's being done like that.
A lot of people, yeah. It was that bad on the police and the drug thing that they was, you couldn't walk. No,
right.
You know, it's like, yeah. But yeah. I really don't think it had to do with me being black. It was just, they don't ask questions on this drug thing. They just, if you're standing out, boom, they, but it ain't like that now.
Okay, so it's gotten better. Okay. That's what I was trying to, okay. So we've been taking steps for a long time to make things better. The more training we get, the better. You know, like I always try to use the analogy of a dentist. If I'm going to go to a dentist, I don't want a guy who went to the dental academy and then got put out in the dentistry business.
And then, dentistry guy?
Yeah, and then 10 years later, he's still assessing your dentistry the same way as he did 10 years ago. I think that's a mistake, and I think it's a question for the community. How much training do we want our officers to have to address? And you've said more.
How long have you been doing this training?
For this department, since about 2015.
And you mentioned that diversity training has been going on since 1999. I'm curious about
so
the contrast between the fair and impartial and the diversity training.
Okay, so a difference between fair and impartial policing training and the diversity training we had. The diversity training we had was conducted by Dr. Aaron Thompson of Kentucky State University. Great guy. I think now he's their chancellor I don't know. He's so smart they promoted him, you know. It's what we all hope for, but I miss him. But he was a wonderful guy, and he would walk us through diversity training and challenge why we thought about things. And I see this fair and impartial policing as kind of the next step, because Aaron had a lot of anecdotal and scientific. No, that's I think really. We stopped that about 6 years ago, maybe seven, and I think that was partly due to just a change in the perception of its effectiveness, and I think he got promoted, like I said, to the pretty high in his organization. This fair and impartial policing kind of picks up where he left off. Excuse me. I ate some Mexican food earlier, and I feel like my face is flushing red because I ate like the hottest stuff I've eaten in a year, I think. So this is based on the scientific study of human bias. Like, what do people at Harvard and Stanford and Yale and Florida State University, they've looked into the scientific measurement of implicit bias, human bias, and explicit bias. Explicit bias, remember, is easy to spot. That would be like the moron neo-Nazis that came to town about 5 or 6 years ago. Remember, they had some little march down. I don't know if you were here then, but...
Westboro Baptist Church.
This is different. But so anyhow, those morons came to town, but they would tell you to your face that they believed that they were a superior race, and I don't know if you saw those guys, but it must have been in their own opinion. Implicit bias is more, it's something all of us have that can drive a decision. The best news that I've heard about implicit bias is if you recognize that all humans have implicit bias, you can put it in neutral. You can kick it out of your decision-making process. And that's why I think personally this is the next step and perhaps the right way to go to prepare our officers to go out here and encounter ambiguous stimuli and make a decision. We never know the whole story. You know, it's like Grandma said, there's three sides to every story. You know, your side, the other guy's side, and the truth. And somewhere in there is usually the truth.
To add to that is every once in a while you'll see someone else reacting to you based on their bias and see that for what it is. And as police officers with this training, it helps you to think of how to intervene. And I can give you an example very quickly.
Sure.
We had a local car dealership, had several cars stolen in one night. One of them was a black Dodge pickup, a certain year. And I'm going up Paris Road and I see a black Dodge pickup. And I have a stolen truck, kind of excited. I get behind it, run the plate. It's of the same year, but the plate hasn't come back. The guy pulls into O'Reilly Automotive on Paris Road, and as I'm pulling in behind him, and I've been following him for a while, waiting on our dispatcher to give me the read back on the plate, the read back comes back, and it's not the truck. So he gets out of the car, and he just happened to be a black guy. I didn't know that when I was behind him. And he gets out of the car, and he looks angry, because I'm stopped. I'm not stopped like I was pulling a car over. I stopped as I was getting ready to leave, and I thought, that guy thinks I'm just following him. I mean, it just clicked. That guy just thinks I'm just following him for no reason. So I stopped and I said, hey, do you have a second? And yeah, you know, he was upset. And I said, this is what's going on. You might get followed because there's not a lot of these trucks around. It was one of the big Dodge pickups. And I said, just so you know, it's a year off from the model that was stolen. Nice truck, but it's going to draw attention. He said, I'm really glad you stopped to talk. You know, his whole demeanor changed. The problem is I don't always have the time to do that, and I don't always recognize it for what it is. But in that instance, it was like, okay, I need to stop and tell this guy what's going on, because he's just going to think that the white police officer followed the black guy, and that's not what was going on.
Excuse me, did you call his name in?
No.
Okay. Every time I've stopped. Every time, it doesn't matter if I'm a bike, whatever, they're calling my name in to see if I have a warrant. And they never stop me unless they do that. But that was good. That was nice that you did.
Well, and that's not the point I was making. The point I was making is because we're going through training like this, it causes you to recognize when other people are reacting to what they are perceiving.
And that's one of the informal ways you can assess if some of these trainings that you're talking about, the diversity training and this fair and impartial policing training, are working. That's the other challenge, to decide, you know, based on the resources that you're putting into it, like you talked about, you know, how you go about measuring the effectiveness of it. And, you know, some of that's on a case-by-case basis, and some of it's probably really difficult to, because it's so, as far as whether it's working or not.
If I may, this gentleman's situation on the surface looks like racial profiling.
Okay.
On the surface. I think I'm headed in the right direction, but if I'm not, just, is there any other questions out there? 6 months or so ago, traffic stop data was broadcast. Rather published, I should say, and immediately some groups jumped on it as evidence of racial profiling. Mm-hmm. Other groups said no. I heard you say to the MU journalism student here before this session started that the data collected is mandated by law. Who decided what data is collected? Because bad data is worse than no data.
I would interject and say it's not bad data. The data is the data.
No.
And what does the data tell us, and what are you going to further study based on the Attorney General's? Let me finish. The Attorney General's data might cause you to say, well, it looks like based on our stops, we're stopping black people more. Maybe we should look at why that is. Maybe there's reasons that we can benignly explain that. And it also shows that black people are searched at a much higher rate than white people are after the stop. The after the stop data is really important. And that should lead you down a path to say, well, why is that? What factors play into that? Is it socioeconomic? Is it criminal? Is it black, white? What is it, implicit bias? Right? The data is just a beginning point. The data is what the data is. How you interpret it and what you choose to look deeper into based on that data is the key to the Attorney General's report. The Attorney General report tells us not very much at all.
I agree and I disagree. I agree that the search information
that's really important
is valid. There's absolutely no question in my mind that that is valid. However, to get to that subset, you had other data that was incomplete. There is not enough data there to say.
Which tells you something. That says, well, we need more complete data in order to understand, so we obviously need to collect A, B, and C because we're not getting that part of the picture.
And that goes right to the root of my question. Who decided what data to collect from which some conclusions cannot be drawn, mm-hmm. even though on the surface it looks like they can, whereas other conclusions can be?
But what do you think is missing?
I don't know what's missing, but that's I can tell you, let me finish.
The department's job to figure it out.
It's not their responsibility to figure it out because they have been told what data they have to collect. My question is, have you ever been in with an officer and made a traffic stop? There's no way in the world you can tell the race of the individual until you exit the vehicle and walk up and look in the driver's side window. It's almost impossible. All you're looking at is the back of someone's head. I'm going to stop that person because the back of their head looks like.
So maybe what the report should tell the department is maybe we need to not look at traffic stops quite so much. Maybe we really need to look at this disparity in searches. That's something that can be gleaned from the data, because the numbers are what they are.
Most people that read the newspaper articles didn't go nearly
as far. That's the newspaper articles.
Didn't go nearly as far as you did, or
well,
I did. They just accepted, they read stops.
Which also tells the police department that they need to do a little better. Who's in that communications department? You know, disseminating information to the public.
No, that's reporters reading the data and
reporting. Yes, it is.
No, it's reporters reading the data and analyzing it.
The police department can come back and with their own interpretation that's a little deeper than the data is back.
And I think if you had been listening to what Chief Burton said, he said the data is faulty from the get-go.
Well, maybe we should just talk about the fair and impartial policing.
Yeah.
The training. Leave the data for another thing.
But who decided?
Not that I wouldn't want to talk about the data.
That's fine. I'd just like to know who decided
what
data was to be collected.
As best I recall, I think that law was written in 99, and I think it was drafted by, I can't remember where they were from now. I want to say Kansas City. Sir? Right.
The actual details of what's collected were worked out by representatives of the legislature when they write the code of regulations.
Right. I mean that's so lawmakers decided
what they need to collect.
What's that?
Comes down from Just City what they need to collect per department, right, and report.
Yeah, it's a uniform set of data from all over the state. In other words, Columbia can't just report X, Y, and Z, everybody has a mandate of you must record this, this, and this. And so that's where the kind of the definition of what or the, yeah.
And this won't be solved tonight, but I can tell you that one, and this is a personal rub of mine, this is not me speaking on behalf of the police department, this is my rub. We have people, and I used to be one of them, that said, we got to do this, and we have to collect this, and we have to analyze this. We have to have resources to do that.
Yeah.
And until we have those resources, or someone outside of the police department offers those resources.
Or a system set up to easily check A, B, C, D, whatever it is you're supposed to be collecting, right?
And when we clear traffic stops, for example, we put information in based on, and we actually collect more than what the Attorney General requires us to do. But we have to go through and click each one of those boxes.
Yeah.
And we have to fill in data. That's time away from an officer going somewhere else to deal with something else. And people don't recognize that, and they'll say, well, let's just do this one more thing. If you haven't ridden with us, I encourage you to do it, because you'll see how those just one more things add up, where it's almost... It can hamstring officers in certain situations not to be able to get their work done.
And then they need somebody to interpret that with some kind of intelligent intent and teach you guys how to interpret it and be better and whatever it may be. So it all, if there's resources required at every step and every level.
But
it's not that.
That's true, but
you require that.
You have to come out with an open mind and not with an agenda.
Right.
Yeah.
And you have to recognize it for what it is as being data, because I cannot interpret someone's intentions based on numbers.
No.
And believe me, I've tried.
And yet, we can learn something from looking at large groups of numbers. So there's a resource element there that's missing,
sure.
Right?
Right.
Because it isn't nothing. It's valuable to gather it. It's valuable to interpret it.
If it's the right stuff.
And it helps the community and it helps the police. And you can't hamstring the police and you can't just say the data's bad.
Well,
right? The truth is somewhere in the middle.
Well, I think it's incomplete. I think what Lieutenant Jones is saying is if we had more information, it would clarify it for all parties. Us included, and for citizens included. I mean, I think we owe it to the citizens to have a better, more accurate picture, because we're all making decisions based on some data. And I think a little bit more data would be helpful. But what I don't want to say is that we're dismissing it summarily, because we're not. It would just be more helpful. I don't. Did you have something else?
I have a question about the actual course you're giving here. Is that a benchmark course that's given to other police departments too?
This course?
Missouri? Yeah.
This course is taught nationwide. The Department of Justice, the United States Department of Justice, and the community-oriented policing put this together, and it's given to departments. You know, Chicago PD, New York PD, Columbia PD, small departments all over the nation. It's really gone all over.
So they're all depending on the same data that you talked about, the contact theory revisited.
If they choose to participate.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is a volunteer. It's not mandated by any federal law. I don't want to misspeak.
It's a message that's...
Oh, yes, a consistent message. Yeah.
That was the other takeaway that I've had that I found myself thinking about a lot is
Fridell's webpage is very good on background information.
Who's that?
Lori Fridell, F-R-I-D-E-L-L.
Right. She's the designer. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I feel we could talk and quibble and argue about the day of a flight for hours and hours and hours.
Yes.
But I have a question. I've been thinking about how your training is integrated into other aspects of police training. And you might remember... when we had on Saturday, when we had the image of the bicyclist, I raised a third possibility, like an outside box one, saying, well, maybe an experienced police officer might have a background of experience training that when he saw that image, his reaction to it, his stereotypical reaction, his sense making of that image might be something that nobody else thought of. And like if it's a commercial where they kind of show something to you to get you thinking of long stereotyped way of thinking, and then all of a sudden something else pops up.
Mm-hmm.
And that impact, that dramatic, really gets your attention, makes an impression on you, and makes you remember something different. I know some police officers who were in the military, maybe in a counterinsurgency or anti-terrorism unit. When I was looking at that lady on a bicycle, I thought, well, might they think that that's a suicide bomber, you know? Maybe they have a completely different image based on their background and their experience, and for somebody to kind of think outside that box, that might be very important. That might seem to run against a little bit of, you know, not thinking of a biased situation to try to... be aware of your implicit unconscious biases,
mm-hmm.
yet for their own safety and for public safety, I think all police officers, especially in this day and age, probably have to think of unlikely situations where something might be set up to draw them in or to fool people. Just like we see the terrorists when they set off a bomb, then they set up a second one after everybody's flocking in you know, that natural impulse to go to the
sure.
aid of people. So how do you incorporate your bias training into the really complex contemporary emerging issues that police officers have to face?
You know, I think it goes back to what somebody said earlier. If we walk into something with a bias, we are less safe than if we walk in with an open mind. And, you know, again, I'll just, the research demonstrates this. If you're one of the role plays that we typically do, well, actually, I think we did it here, was send officers to a kind of a vague, ambiguous call. There's been a weapon in the past. And invariably, what we find our officers do is frisk the man for weapons, because that's constitutionally correct and legally and tactically correct. And they will not frisk the woman, because they're thinking, well, who has a gun most often? That's experience, right? And who's the biggest danger to me? That's projecting their threat assessment. And so that becomes a bias, and it's kind of a stereotype. When you go, if I tell you that right now we have Columbia police officers at a house because of a domestic disturbance, and one party has suffered a broken nose and a tooth knocked out, probably everybody in this room thought, what did that guy do to that woman? Or some semblance thereof. Because that's our bias. Who's the violent person? So we think that's unsafe. We think that everybody has a bias, but if you know it, you can put it in neutral. You can kick it out of your decision. Because if there's a vague call of a disturbance with a weapon, like they acted out, you're safer in that specific fact pattern that we gave there to search both parties and not immediately dismiss the lady as the victim or to assume that the man is the aggressor. And so that, I think that's kind of what you're asking there. And that's the other thing that is, it's so difficult to get right as a police officer. I would not go to a dentist who, as soon as he called you from the waiting room, said, come on in, you got a cavity. You're next. Come on in, you got a cavity. I mean, nobody would want to go to that guy, right? We'd want a dentist who would say, sit here, we're going to x-ray you, we're going to examine your mouth, and then maybe she'd say, your teeth look great, or you have a cavity, but you would feel better about that than just an assumption, right? And so the hard part about policing is, I don't know what the biggest danger outside downtown in Columbia is right now. I don't know if it's a drunk guy with a gun. I don't know if it's somebody on the run with heroin who thinks they have a warrant, who's paranoid and has a knife. I don't know if it's a college kid walking out and getting in a car to drunk drive. I don't know. But society turns to us and says, oh, make downtown safe. Safe from who, from what? What, you know, what's your definition of safe? Is it driving here and home without getting T-boned by a drunk driver? Or, you know, I mean, that's kind of what puts police in this constant horrible equation to make a bad decision based on bias.
Going back to your scenario just now, domestic dispute, somebody's lost a tooth and has a broken nose.
Yeah.
I think everybody in here, given enough time to think about that situation, could remove bias, their implicit bias, from their thought process. Law enforcement officers are required to make that kind of a decision, oftentimes in a split second.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back to my earlier comment about the frequency with which this training takes place, because people are going to fall back on old habits until new habits are ingrained in them. So I don't, certainly, I was about to say, you can't do this enough. But you can't use the entire training budget just to do this. There's too many other things that are as important, if not more so.
Yeah.
But the frequency with which this training needs to take place, I think, I'd like to see it as often, at least annually.
And or other supports and social media and you know, resources and reading lists. I have a number of friends, we share books. We don't have a formal book group, but somebody reads it and passes it along and around. And there's other social ways that information and training can get disseminated that might not eat up a training budget because resources are stretched. So
hang on one second. Let me come back. Sir?
Does Fidel supply alternative materials? Because you can't just present the same material again and again. Officers are going to doze off on it.
That's right.
And also, there are limitations to what you can do in a class. She herself says that the main thing that people need to learn to soften the implicit bias is more contact with people they don't normally have contact with, especially if it involves counter stereotypes.
Right.
That if you never knew, for instance, I grew up never knowing any African Americans who weren't servants or gardeners or that sort of thing. I never knew a black doctor. So at the time, so there was a period in my life where I needed contact like that. I needed to be in a class with a really bright black kid and find out that all black people are just nice housekeepers that I knew growing up. But that sort of thing is hard to organize for officers. The coffee with the cop sort of thing is worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get the right people to show up, and if there's a relaxed enough atmosphere in which people can really start a conversation which goes somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you tend to stick to safe ground in conversation, so it's hard to create those sorts of things.
We call that
if you throw officers into as many opportunities where they are making those cross-cultural connections, and that's what the community policing is about.
Yeah.
That if you have someone at Douglas Park just interacting with people and playing pickup, the right sort of thing happens. So you need a combination of the formal training and then officers realizing that they need that contact and they have to go out and find it one way or another for themselves.
Well, there's so many of the programs that they used to have over the years have gone now by a bunch of budget cuts. And I know that their program is found to be ineffective as far as the fighting the war on drugs, but as far as my view of seeing all those officers, kids, now all those kids over the years, and the Youth Academy being canceled this last summer, just absolutely.
What was the Youth
My son
Academy?
Was really excited to do that again, and it was completely eliminated. And he still talks about the experiences that he had and the officers that he got to know better. And I just, that's my thing right now. I know they're going to do the Let's Talk. Or they're talking about some other programs, but I think that's extremely important for that contact with the kids. You were talking about the kids.
Let me come back to him for just a second, sir.
Yeah. Right. What was your name?
Don
Connors. He kind of hit it on the head. It's a the classroom thing is going to be helpful as far as information goes. Data, the impactors of every piece of data you guys have been talking about is going to be, the biggest impact is going to be community relationships. And so we can't expect the police to have no relationships with a certain set of people like downtown. It's party weekend, these kids coming in for food or partying crazy, and be expected to look at those statistics and say, they're doing something wrong. That's really not realistic. But in the community, so say I don't know what to call you by your first name or Hester in here, but say my brother.
It's all good.
Say my brother's in the community, he's in there 10 years. We have a better relationship. So there's going to be a different path that he can take based on that relationship, and so that data's going to be impacted by that. And some of those biases are naturally going to fade away. And that's on both ends. Our relationship is good enough to where these two were making a traffic stop one time when they were two kids, and my instinct was to come watch, and I found myself thinking I could protect these guys, and I had to pull off. I don't know if you knew that, Mike said. But I had to pull off because I'm thinking to myself, wait, they got guns. They got all of these things. But they were so loose with the people that they were talking to. There was no handcuffs. They were kind of just walking around. And I'm thinking to myself, isn't that dangerous for them? But that came from relationship. You see, I know these guys. I know they have integrity. I know their policing is built on that integrity. And so if you put someone with them, then that integrity is going to rub off, you know. And then that starts to break down kind of the boundaries or the biases for other police officers. But it also impacts kids like me, you know, that now when I see them, I kind of want them to make some time for me. And if they don't, I think they're acting funny, you know. So it's one of those things. But we can get real big. You know, it can be a big budget thing. It can be mandated. It can be all of this type of stuff. And everybody's going to get credit for coming to the class. And they're good people for coming to the class. But really, it's about the relationship in the community. So when we talk about the biases or bias policing, what we're really talking about is a broken relationship between people. So let's deal with each other. Let's just fix the relationship. Sorry.
Creating intersections between various communities is really the way to do that. It's really important. You know, people need to not be afraid of the police. It's just takes one bad episode to create fear and magnify it by multiplying. In fact, we're talking to friends, and one good interaction with an officer can, you know, lower that, lessen that, minimize that.
Yeah, it doesn't take much.
It doesn't take much. Humanizes it. You know, there's a lot of communities that we don't all interact with.
And I don't like these guys.
Intersections are good.
At all, period. I'm just saying, you know.
Didn't Chief Burton was trying to instill community policing here some time ago, past year or so? And they were going to break up areas and go away from traffic control and stuff and concentrate more on the community. And what happened to that? Are they still pursuing that, or is that back where?
So brought that up. It's kind of funny that you bring that. That's Scott Linyard. He's a community outreach unit officer in the North neighborhood. Mike Hester, the sergeant of the community outreach unit. He oversees the other six. And I'm the guy who goes and talks about training and budget and all of that stuff for him. So we have three strategic neighborhoods, one north, Bodie Currituck area, one east, Indian Hills area, one central, Douglas Park, and general area. Those are the three strategic neighborhoods. Everybody recognizes that that's not enough, but it all comes down to resources that we've talked about. So these guys
talked to Chief Burton and asked him why he did away with the traffic unit. He might get a little bit testy because maybe the unit per se has been disbanded, but police officer hours as far as doing traffic enforcement and traffic response, that's all still there.
We don't have a standalone traffic unit, but we do have resources committed to the neighborhoods. And do you want Scott to talk about his neighborhood a little bit and kind of what he's doing there?
Sure. We got about 10 minutes because I promised the folks that we'll be out here at 8:30. But
it's an ongoing process. Tony was back here. You were talking about training, what we're going to do ongoing. Tony and I just met yesterday, and we're talking about some of the ideas that we had and trying to find grant funding for it. So it's progressive, different, but gets those things going. So those conversations are happening. I can't promise anything yet until I get the funding, but we're working on it. So
that's really good to know.
Yeah.
So, good.
But yes, we have a community outreach unit. I'm pretty proud of them because they're the stuff.
All right, so I'm going to kind of wind this down just a little bit because I did tell this guy we'd be out at 8:30. So it sounds like, and I'm paraphrasing everybody here, so if I get it really wrong, feel free to let me know. But you guys think that this training was good, but we need to build on it with more realistic role plays perhaps, what somebody said, more of the use of force role plays and more frequency. Is that a good summation? I'm just trying to scribble notes as we talked here.
Outside of work hours, continuing education.
Well, and see, the problem with that is
What kind of benefits could you give them?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, buy them a box of donuts if they complete the book. I don't know. Totally
stereotypical.
I know that. I'm kidding.
With teaching, we used to have, when I retired, they were starting to defund some of it, but they had this thing called Career Ladder, where if you would do certain things above and beyond your regular teaching duties, that you could earn. Do police have anything like that?
We no longer have that. We used to have a, what was it called? Career development, same thing.
It was some kind of incentive.
Yeah, and there was incentive for pay for doing what you're talking about here and being involved in the community, obtaining a degree, obtaining a higher education.
Getting involved with certain programs.
Getting involved with programs, that was all.
But
that's gone due to city resources, you know. And that's, when I say that, I mean, please understand I'm not being critical of anybody above me, beside me. It's just I'm a cop, and the people who control the budget, I mean, they know the bigger picture there. Talk about big numbers, you know. But it's hurt our department. Part of it was financial. Part of it was
promotional.
I think it had some to do with that. But that's, it's gone.
Yeah.
You've heard me say this in other meetings before. You've heard me say it. As a community outreach unit, our goal is to work with what we have. We can hope for more,
right?
But we have to make do with what we have. So we're going to try to make fit everything that we can.
It's nice to know that there's grants and things like that.
Well, we're trying to find them. There's,
if you know of any,
yeah, let us know.
Call us. My card's on the table.
You need to be a professional grant troll to know everything that's out there. It's astounding.
There's a lot of
people
in education that do that kind of thing.
They do.
People in law
enforcement
that are
involved.
Yeah.
I'm
sorry,
I interrupted you.
Oh, it's okay.
You were summarizing, and I got you
off track. That's all right. It was a good question. You know, I mean, it seemed like a logical way to get there, you know.
Keep going, Michael P.
Okay. And so, you know, we talked about the data, and I think that's a different discussion. I'm glad to be part of that as well. I just think we ought to stick to the training tonight. Let's see. Who wrote these notes? They're scribbled on here. The use of social media and alternative training. And then the contact theory. You know, that's really what Lieutenant Jones and I designed the outreach unit to be about, was the contact theory. And it's interesting to me in our strategic neighborhoods, the good work that officers like Scott do every day when they go out there and they get to know their community better. So Aaron was talking about the broken relationships. We've mended some of those fences, and I think it's made a positive difference. And like you said earlier, it's kind of a win-win. Policing is ugly. No one will ever like us. It's not a popularity contest. There's no way to enforce a rule without offending someone, and there's no way in this day and age to do anything without someone interpreting it based on 3 to 7 seconds of video. And those of you who are at the class on Saturday, I don't explain or excuse bad police behavior. I'm just saying 3 to 7 seconds is not context for what occurred. And I'll just challenge you in your own life, if there's been 3 to 7 seconds that you did something either violent or angry, if I only looked at that, or if we put your video up on the screen, what would that look like? I mean, you must look at the bigger picture. And that takes courage on the part of the police and the citizens. And I think what you were saying earlier, and I can't remember the exact phrase you used, but I would like to see more of our police officers come to these kind of things.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you why they won't.
Yeah, we never get to hear from anybody but Burton, and he's not a master communicator. Let's just say it, okay? And I can say that because I don't work for him. But it would be really nice to hear from more.
Let Mike finish.
He was going to say, why not?
So I think the reason that police officers are a little hesitant to is so if... And I'll throw myself under the bus for this. I was challenged one time by a citizen why I'm always picking on their neighborhood. Why am I out messing with them
and that was walking around, introducing myself to people, stopping cars when they did traffic violations, investigating crimes. And I said, because there's people getting shot and killed down here. And there's no reason for me to go to the nice area of town where people are mad because somebody stole their yard gnome or whatever it is. You know, and I'm not trying to say those crimes aren't important. I'm just saying that looks ugly, though. So if you just hear cop wants to stay in the bad neighborhood, the fear among police is that maybe people with bias will turn that into cops just want to police this certain demographic. And that could be damaging to the community. And so I think all of us, and I've tried to model it by throwing myself under the bus, need to be courageous, and I'll challenge everybody. I have some of the most fun conversations with some of the biggest police critics. And really what usually happens is they're like, well, I never thought of it that way. And there's some things they've said where I'm like, I never thought of it that way. And that's the contact theory at work. But that takes courage. And that takes also the ability to step back and not jump to a conclusion. And that's why a lot of police officers are hesitant to come to these meetings, is there's going to be someone who beats them about the head with either one phrase or one thing that they have nothing to do with. You were asking about the profiling law, the racial Missouri, it should be called the anti-racial profiling law. See, they not only did they write sketchy collection stuff, in my opinion, but they should have called it the anti-racial profiling law. Anyhow, we didn't get a choice in what we collect. It was just handed to us, do this. And so I don't know what the fix is for that, but probably better legislation. Anyhow, that's my summary.
Not only did he get to have a choice, he's the one.
It was a good idea.
That makes it easy.
He's the guy with good ideas. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
All right. And my card's back there. If you have any follow-up things, I've been bad on email this week because, I've been off and I've had some life going on outside here. So if I missed an email from you, don't give up on me. I promise.
No angry letters.
I promise.
No angry letters.
Email from me. Don't give up on me.